Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 3rd of September 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live at RadioAlbion.com because we will be discussing today Crete and the Minoan civilization and I will introduce my co-host shortly. But just before we get into that, I just want to remind listeners that I am wanting to hear from you as an accusation has been made against me that what I say is likely to stir up hate. So I would like to hear from you, the listeners, how Radio Albion makes you feel, why you listen, and especially if you have been inspired to take any action. Especially good is if you have been listening since the Radio Aryan days and can comment on any changes you may have noticed over the years. So if you could write that down for me and send it to stormersubs@hushmail.com or add it to the Discus comments, add it to the Radio Albion chat room or on Telegram or on Gab or any of the ways that you have to contact me, that would be much appreciated. Well, tonight we're going to be getting into Crete and the Minoan civilization, and I have with me, as always, my co-host, the Patriarch. Patriarch, how are you doing, sir? You still away on holiday, are you?
I'm still away, not quite on holiday. We're basically visiting my wife's family, so I'm pretty much working and just situated in Romania at the moment. So managed to find some quiet time. They're actually at her mother's house now, so we can do these live.
Well, that's good. That's good. Is there a lot of historical places over there in Romania, old churches, that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. It's full of large sort of cathedrals, Orthodox and Catholic. So it's kept to its traditional religious roots. It's quite nice, actually. Her mother actually lives in a village, so it's quite a different way of life out here. They're very much connected to the earth and soil. You know, they've got chickens. Her mum's constantly just picking stuff from the garden. It's really long stretch of land, the garden, and she's just always busy, whether she's making jams or, you know, picking potatoes and tomatoes and figs off trees. It's quite a charming way of life, really.
She sounds like a very good role model for your wife. I'm very very pleased for you. Sounds like you're having a good time. Well, we will actually be talking about things from a female perspective quite a lot tonight, actually, as well, and gender differences, because the Minoan civilization is really famous for the snake goddess, this woman with her breasts out. And apparently there was quite a difference between the way that men were treated and the way that women were treated back then. And it does seem as if it was a bit of a matriarchy. And we'll be getting into all of that. But first off, we'll just take a look at the civilization itself. The Minoan civilization was part of the first great age of civilization, with this Bronze Age Aegean civilization being on the island of Crete and the other Aegean islands surrounding it. It flourished from 3000 BC to 1450 BC, so at the same time as the Sumerian civilization and the Indus Valley one, and after a late period of decline, it finally ended around 1100 BC during the early Greek Dark Ages when the Bronze Age collapsed. It represents the first advanced civilization in Europe, leaving behind massive building complexes, tools, artwork, writing systems, and a massive network of trade. The civilization was rediscovered at the beginning of the 20th century through the work of another British archaeologist, Sir Arthur Evans this time, who was the first man in millennia to uncover the lost palace of Knossos. And the name Minoan derives from the mythical king Minos, and was coined by Evans, who identified the site at Knossos as the labyrinth with the Minotaur from the Greek myth. And the Minotaur was half bull, half man, and I think it was Perseus and Ariadne gave him a ball of wool, and he took the ball of wool into the labyrinth, and he was able to kill the Minotaur and then work his way out through with the ball of wool. So that's the origin of this, because it looked like a labyrinth. The palace itself is very labyrinthine. He identified it as this is the place where this took place. And the Minoan civilization has been described as the earliest of its kind in Europe, and the historian Will Durant called the Minoans the first link in the European chain, and it's right up close there to the Levant, basically. That's who they would have been trading with, and Phoenicia. And this bit with the labyrinth is very interesting, because we have in Rocky Valley in Tintagel in Cornwall, we have a labyrinth on the wall there that they believe goes back to the Bronze Age. We see a similar labyrinth on the floor of, I think it's Chartres Cathedral, one of the French cathedrals. And we also used to have these labyrinth mazes that we used to build in the Middle Ages out of grass and out of turf. And we used to call them Troy Town mazes. And apparently they were based on the walls around Troy. You, if you try to break into Troy, apparently you would get lost in between the walls. And that was similar to this palace, this Knossos palace. So that we have a link there between Troy and Crete and also Britain. So it's basically saying it's the same people. And also this King Minos, L.A. Waddell, believed that he was the same character as Menes the Egyptian, who started the Egyptian civilization. And I'm inclined to believe, to go along with him, that all these civilizations were connected up and it was basically the same people. But whether it was exactly the same person, Menes the Egyptian, as King Minos, I'm not sure. You got any comments on that?
Well, I was just wondering, when you say the first in the European chain, you think it was an offshoot from Sumer and the peoples that then went on to populate Europe and sort of the coastlands, and you're saying that these people were sort of the first kind of civilizations outside of that Fertile Crescent?
Yeah, it's just a bit, it's not that far outside of the Fertile Crescent. It's just within shipping distance of the Levant, basically, when you look at where Crete is. So you had Sumer, and as we talked about with the Indus Valley civilization, you had the Arabian Gulf, and they would just travel through that past Persia, and then you've got what's now Pakistan and India, and that's on one side of it. And then if you head in the other direction from Sumer, you get to Phoenicia, you get to the Levant, you get to that big coastal strip, and then if you go out at sea from there, you end up at Crete. So it's sort of spreading out from Sumer. But there was also the Hittite Empire. And in Cappadocia, which is in Turkey, there was a center of civilization there as well. And L.A. Waddell believed that was the original one. And then people set out from there. And then they started the one at Sumer. They started the one at Crete. They started the one at Egypt and the Indus Valley one, because there are connections between all of them. There are similarities. They were all at the same standard of civilization. They were all using bronze. They all had sanitation, sewage, and various ones of the civilizations were best at doing one particular thing, like the Indus Valley were best at producing the wells, and they developed the circular well, and these guys were best at sorting out the sewage, basically. And they had running water, and they had a water purification system, aqueducts, yeah, bringing the water in. I mean, really, really massively advanced. But yeah, I think it was Europeans or Aryans or whatever, you white people, whatever you want to call them, that started off these civilizations in that area. And this is one of the ones that they started. Why they started it on this island, I'm not particularly sure. Apparently, this King Minos, he got rid of all the pirates because there were pirates in that sea area and they would rob the ships. And he wiped them all out, basically, and made it so that it was possible to do the trading. I guess that island would have been easier to get from Northern Europe with the tin. Instead of going over land, maybe you could go by sea and then you could get to Crete. And then from Crete, they could then transport it on to Phoenicia, maybe, possibly.
Possibly. I went to Croatia last year, one of the islands, and we went for a walk around this mountain, and there was the sort of vague remnants of an old civilization, and I think it dates to kind of similar time, 3,000, 2,500 BC or something, and I'm pretty sure that it mentioned that there were offshoots of people like the Minoans and the Messians that kind of ended up populating the island there. I'm pretty sure there's a connection. I just need to double check that, but they probably went and colonized a lot of different coastal regions around there.
Yeah, the Mycenaeans came in and they warred against the Minoans, and apparently it was the Minoans that brought the gifts of civilization to the Athenians and the Greeks. And you also had the Pelasgians in that area. All that Balkans area was sort of took off after this first wave of civilization took off in the Fertile Crescent and Egypt. And then after that, you had the Athenian civilization and the people around that. But at the same time, you also had white people that were colonizing those areas, and that was the Pelasgians and the Thracians, and they would have been in Croatia. There's a guy in the chat room, Okamaten. He's really interested in this stuff. He translates a lot of the Bulgarian histories into English. Maybe when we get a chance to look at that area, maybe we'll get him on the show as well to talk about it a bit.
Yeah, sounds good.
Well, the Minoan civilization is particularly notable for its large and elaborate palaces, which were up to 4 stories high, featuring elaborate plumbing systems and decorated with frescoes. The Minoans were traders, and their cultural contacts reached the old kingdom of Egypt, copper-containing Cyprus, Canaan, the Levantine coast, and Anatolia. And Anatolia was Turkey, that was Cappadocia. They also clearly had contact with Britain, since this was the Bronze Age, and tin is required to make bronze, and the only tin mines around were in Britain. And that's the bit that they always leave out from the mainstream histories. They just don't know where the tin came from. Well, we identified where the tin came from. It came from Cornwall, because there's nowhere else that it could have come from. It's interesting that they had 4-story-high palaces. I mean, when you think the cities like Amsterdam and the main cities in Europe, I don't think they go much higher than 4 stories high in a house today, do they?
They probably have select ones here and there, but generally, not so high.
So they're pretty advanced when you think this is...
Yeah, definitely.
4,000 or 5,000 years ago. A 2013 archaeogenetics study comparing skeletal mitochondrial DNA from ancient Minoan skeletons that were sealed in a cave in the Lasithi Plateau between 3,700 and 4,400 years ago to 135 samples from Greece, Anatolia, Western and Northern Europe, North Africa, and Egypt. The researchers found that the Minoan skeletons were genetically very similar to modern-day Europeans, and especially close to modern-day Cretans, particularly those from the Lasithi Plateau. They were also genetically similar to Neolithic Europeans, but distinct from Egyptian or Libyan populations. We now know that the founders of the first advanced European civilization were European, said study co-author George Stamatoyanopoulos, a human geneticist at the University of Washington. They were very similar to Neolithic Europeans and very similar to present-day Cretans. And, of course, what you have to look at there, you have to say, well, he says that they were distinct from the Egyptian or the Libyan populations, but at what time are they looking at the Egyptian or the Libyan populations? Because we know that the population, the ethnicity of the population in Egypt changed over time, which we'll be looking at when we look at Egypt next week. And the same with Libya. I think that was called Cyrene at the time. Cyrenia, something like that.
Yeah, I was going to say the modern day Greeks have been somewhat Arabized, haven't they, from the Islamic conquests. I'm not saying most or all Greeks would have been completely mixed, but they would have definitely had a sort of Arabic injection there. So I just wonder how they would have been genetically most similar to the modern day Cretans.
Well, that's another point, isn't it? You know, they could say that they're genetically most similar to them, but if a lot of them are 10% Arab, and they say, they're closest to them because they've got this 90% European, but they've also got this 10% Arab, so that means that it wasn't actually them. But what they're saying here is that the people that did this, they were European, I would say that the people that were in the Fertile Crescent and the people that were Egypt, we would describe them as European as well. They were the same people. I don't think this group here that were in Crete, I don't think they came out from Northern Europe and made their way to Crete. I think they made their way to Crete from the Fertile Crescent. Like we talked about with the in the earlier episodes about the sons of Noah and after the flood, and wherever that was, it was somewhere in the Fertile Crescent. It was either in Anatolia, which would explain why these civilizations were close to there, or it was actually in the Fertile Crescent in Sumer itself, because we know there was this huge flood there, and that wiped out the previous civilization, which wasn't up to a very high standard of civilization. And then suddenly at that time, 3000 BC, civilization bursts forth with metalworking and calendars and complex systems that they never had before. And that all took place at that time. And, you know, the Bible tells us that the sons of Noah eventually became, I forget what it is, 60 or 70 different specific nations. And they spread out from there to the east, the west, and the north and the south. So, you know, whether that's exactly what happened and it was individuals, or whether that's talking about a population movement of white people that left from that center, it doesn't matter. I mean, but that is basically what happened. When we see these civilizations taking off, they all spread out from that first one that's in the Fertile Crescent. So that's the way I see it.
I was doing some research earlier on haplogroups, because there's some people which were questioning the notion of the sort of Adamic line and the tracing of human roots and that through haplogroups. And I'm not normally so interested in this, but I had a look into it. And according to this, that everyone starts from what's called a Y haplogroup, according to this science. I'm not saying that I'm on board with it fully, but everyone apparently stems from this Y haplogroup, and then some branch off. And then when you get to the Middle East, Mesopotamia, you start to get into the K and R haplogroups, where pretty much civilization spawns from. And I just think it's massively coincidental. And so, you know, I posed the question to someone that if from the biblical standard, the place of origin for Adam was in Eden, which is near the Euphrates, then surely that's kind of a definition, or is associated with these specific haplogroups, which are synonymous with whites, as opposed to, you know, the founding haplogroup, which was in Africa, if you understand. So even there, there's kind of a suggestion that the Adamic man actually started later, and it wasn't from Africa.
So it was the R1B1 haplogroup, I think, something like
that. Yeah, exactly.
I think the main difference is what they say is that the R1B1 evolved from this Y haplogroup, and they will trace that all the way back to Africa and hundreds of thousands of years ago, and say that it all evolved from that. Whereas the Bible will say, well, no, it was a specific creation of Adamic man that took place, and it was a specific type that was created. And that's the difference. But what you're saying, you know, that sort of proves that, doesn't it? Because it says that the R1B1 haplogroup, it just suddenly appeared alongside the Y haplogroup. So a specific type of man appeared in the Fertile Crescent about 6,000 to 7,000 years ago. And that specific
it was an offshoot, and I think there was a K group or something as well. I didn't really look into that too much, but definitely the R groups kind of branched off from the Fertile Crescent area and around Mesopotamia. I just thought that was really interesting, and since we was talking on that, I wanted to share it. Another point, I just had a quick look on
Can I just add something there? I mean, they also had blonde hair and blue eyes, and they also brought the new idea of farming with them. and agrarianism, mm-hmm. and that is also tied in with that haplogroup. So that's what shows that it was white people, and they were the ones that settled and started growing crops instead of just hunting and gathering, which is what was going on before.
Sure. Well, I mean, civilization pretty much started in that area. So I mean, you know, I think to see how the haplogroups which would have started or fermented in that area, I think it's safe to say were the kind of the founding fathers of Europeans, and what I would suggest as Adam is defined in the Bible as well. You know, the point you made about the particularly those from the Lusitanian Plateau, I just had a look on the map, and I just wonder if, because it's on an actual mountain, it was probably so remote that they had little interaction with surrounding, you know, invading tribes, should I say, Islamic tribes. So that might kind of give us a reason for why they were more similar to the original Minoans back then.
So less likely to have been invaded, an admixture. Yeah. It does look like the civilization just ended and then there was nothing else done there. So they could have just survived that. I think we had a group of people that were surviving on an island in Scotland just eating seagulls for hundreds of years that were only discovered, I don't know, 70 or 80 really? Years ago. Yeah. Yeah, they were quite inbred and they just lived
seagulls,
off.
Seagulls, eh?
Yeah, catching birds and eating them, and they'd all been living on this island. So, it's quite possible that there were groups of people that were just living somewhere untouched, you know, quite close to other centres of civilization. Mm-hmm. Well, the Bronze Age began on Crete around 3200 BC, so that's 200 years after it began in the Fertile Crescent, so that gives enough time for them to spread over there. And by the late 3rd millennium BC, several locations on the island had developed into centres of commerce and handiwork, enabling the upper classes to exercise leadership and expand their influence. It is possible that the original hierarchies of the local elites were then replaced by monarchies, a precondition for the palaces, which began to be constructed during this period of prosperity and stability, during which the early Minoan culture turned into a civilization. And I've been wondering how they defined the monarchy and kings from other leaders or tribal leaders, and that must be it. When they find a palace, it must mean that there's a monarchy there, I guess. And after this, there was an earthquake or invasion, and the civilization arose again for the second or middle Minoan age, culminating around 1700 BC, where the arts of civilization were then exported to Greece. Following another volcanic eruption around 1600 BC, the third or late age began, and by 1200 BC, it was all over. And that was it. And it never saw the light of day again until about 100 years ago, when this British archaeologist started digging around there. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
No, it just goes to show how fragile societies can be, really. If you was to extrapolate what happened there and onto the West, I mean, it's just, it's quite daunting, isn't it? How it can just end overnight, what you think seemingly a invincible culture.
I also find it interesting that we end up building our centres close to volcanoes. I guess maybe that the soil there is very fertile, maybe, because there's quite a few places that we've built, and they've, like San Francisco's built by that fault line, isn't it? You've got Pompeii that was covered in volcanic ash. You've got this place in Crete that had two or three volcanic eruptions that pretty much destroyed it. And maybe they're
just so rare, these cataclysmic natural disasters, that people just naturally expand and feel safe and don't really feel the threat.
Well, they had lots of them. They had lots of them back then. It was the age of catastrophe. Yeah, I want to do an episode on it, actually, looking at all the catastrophes that they had back then. Because it may well be that what we look up and see above us today was actually different back then. You know, we may even had a different strength of gravity. When you start looking into the electric universe theory, and how that came about. And that might even explain how come, you know, you've got 100 ton capstones on some of these dolmens. I mean, how did the people back then lift up a 100 ton capstone to put it on dolmens? And, you know, I've been thinking about that for a long time. How could that occur? And, you know, it may possibly be that we had slightly different gravity back then. The planets looked like they may well have been in a different position. And because of that, that would have exerted a lot more stress on the planet itself. And there would have been storms and hailstorms and all the sort of things you read about in the Bible that you think, well, that's weird. Fire coming out of the sky and all this sort of thing. Well, that would occur if you had the planets a lot closer than they are today. And there are a lot of images that people have drawn in caves that appear to show that the planets were in a different position back then to today. And there are even witnesses that say that they were. And all of this apparently stopped, I think, about 300 or 400 years before Christ. And they call it the Age of Catastrophe up to that point. So it was a different world that they lived in. It really was.
Sounds it. Have you ever seen one of the best things about Albania that I saw was on one of these streets leading up? There was a little, not a store, but you could pay a few dollars or something to have a look in their telescope. I'd never really seen a star or a planet through a telescope before, but I was pretty impressed, to be honest, just to see. You know, Saturn, you're just looking up in the sky and you see like Saturn and Jupiter in quite high detail. It's quite amazing, really. It just puts things in perspective.
Well, if you had no streetlights back then as well, I mean, the night sky would have looked very, very bright. You know, a lot of us nowadays aren't used to seeing the night sky how it should be, with all the stars up there and
I'd read somewhere, some ancient civilizations, I know it's getting away from our patriotic history, but I think it's the Mayans, but didn't they raise some of their children in pitch black darkness, you know, so they didn't see the day, so that when they went out at night, their eyes were just finely attuned to every spot of light and they could pick out the stars and just literally be amazing astrologers.
I seem to recall somewhere that I think there may have been a tribe in the Amazon, and they kept people in a cave and told them what the life was like outside. And then and after initiation, they would take them outside, and then they would be amazed by everything because they'd just been told what it was like before. And I don't know if that was a myth or that was some kind of initiation ceremony.
Yeah, I'd heard that as well. I thought they were separate, you know, events or cultures, but yeah, I'm sure they did a lot of that type of stuff. But hey, it's interesting.
Getting back to Crete here, according to Homer, Crete had 90 cities, starting with a few thousand in each of them in 2500 BC, and growing to 100,000 in them by 1600 BC. These cities were connected by narrow roads paved with blocks cut with bronze saws, and the streets had drainage with water and sewage facilities being available to the upper classes through clay pipes. And they actually had a flushing toilet, a proper flushing toilet. You had to actually use a jug of water to pour it into the toilet, but then it would go away into a sewage pipe and it would get taken away. One of the defining aspects of the Minoan era was the architectural feats of their waste management. The Minoans used technologies such as wells, cisterns, and aqueducts to manage their water supplies, with structural aspects of their buildings even playing a part, as flat roofs and plentiful open courtyards were used for collecting the water to be stored in the cisterns. Significantly, the Minoans also had water treatment devices. One such device seems to have been a porous clay pipe through which water was allowed to flow until clean. Minoan buildings often had flat tiled roofs, plaster wood or flagstone floors, and they stood 2 to 3 stories high, with lower walls being typically constructed of stone and rubble, with the upper walls of mud brick. Ceiling timbers then held up the roofs. So, this is pretty clever stuff, collecting the water, collecting the dew, and then having it go down to a clay pipe where it then gets filtered, and then when it comes out, and they must have had some way to close it off so that it came out under pressure. And it's incredible what they did. And also this bit here with the ceiling timbers that held up the roofs. Normally you get stone columns, and what they used was cypress. They actually used timbers. So when you read in the Bible about these cypresses from Lebanon, that was what they were actually used for. They were used like columns for holding the roof up, and they put them in upside down so that the roots was up at the top, so that their columns were larger at the top than they were at the bottom. Whereas the Greeks did them, their stone ones, they made them larger at the bottom and smaller at the top, so that they looked like they were further away. Whereas they did it the opposite way around in Crete, and they used these cypress trees for it.
It's interesting.
And next we get on to the Minoan women. Minoan society was a highly gendered and divided society, separating men from women in clothing, art, illustration, and societal duties. Artistically, women were portrayed very differently compared to the representations of men. Most obviously, men were often artistically represented with dark skin, while women were represented with lighter skin. And this is something that you see with the Egyptian images as well. And people will look at them and they'll say, oh, look, the Egyptians were non-white. They've all got brown skin. Well, it's because they were just in the sun. And that's why they were depicted with brown skin. Because when you see the women, they will always be depicted with white skin because they weren't working. They weren't doing the physical work. They were inside. Mm-hmm. And the fresco paintings also portray three different classes of women: elite women, women of the masses, and servants. A fourth, smaller class of women are also included among some of the paintings, and these are women who participated in religious and sacred tasks. Elite women were depicted within paintings as having a stature twice the size of the women in the lower classes. Artistically, this was a way of emphasizing the important difference between the elite wealthy women and the rest of the female population within society. And I think this is why we also see in some of the Sumerian pictures and the Assyrian ones, it looks like they've got giants there. And it's basically saying that this was a very important king. That's why he's depicted so at such a huge size. He wasn't actually a physical giant. It was just a way of showing how important these people were. And in this case, yeah, they had important women. So it was more of a matriarchy than a patriarchy.
So it's like a hyperbolic visual representation.
Yeah. Yeah. Within paintings, women were also portrayed as caretakers of children. However, few frescoes portray pregnant women. Most artistic representations of pregnant women are in the form of sculpted pots with the rounded base of the pots representing the pregnant belly. And this is interesting because, you know, if it was a matriarchy, normally we get a matriarchy and you get like fertility sort of religions. You do tend to see pregnancy as well, and lots of images of pregnancy and fecundness and having lots of children, but they didn't have any of that. Additionally, no Minoan art forms portray women giving birth, breastfeeding, or procreating. And they say lack of such action leads historians to believe that these actions would have been recognized by Minoan society to be either sacred or inappropriate. And well, of course, they're going to view procreation as being inappropriate to put in public. And why would you, you know, portray women actually giving birth? The breastfeeding is a strange one because they did show these goddesses with their breasts out. But it's the same as today, really. You know, you don't want to see people procreating in public. That's the sort of thing that you see when society degenerates, isn't it? We saw that in Rome, and we're seeing that now. This lewdness, it always appears before a civilization is absolutely destroyed. As public art pieces such as frescoes and pots do not illustrate these acts, it can be assumed that this part of a woman's life was kept private within society as a whole. Well, yeah, you know, her private life, isn't it? Procreation. It's bizarre, isn't it? When they're writing this, I think they're sort of projecting the way we look upon these things today back then and trying to say, well, look, isn't it a surprise they don't show procreation? Well, throughout history, we've seen that as a private matter, not really something to make public. And that the making of it public is the sort of thing that we see in non-white paganism, with the fertility stuff that they have and orgies and things like that. It's never really been a white thing. The white way has always been about restraining those urges, apart mm-hmm. from when the society yeah. gets really decadent before it collapses. Do you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, I was going to say the same points, really. I sort of noted down that it pretty much marks the decline of this of a society, doesn't it? You know, because you mentioned that it was towards the end, right? At the beginning, they didn't have so much lewd imagery, and it was more towards the latter parts that were becoming more lewd. So,
well, no, they didn't really have any of that. I mean, that's what they're saying. They weren't showing this, but why does the guy who's writing this, why does he expect them to be showing this? It's because our society today tolerates that sort of thing. And he's sort of projecting that onto them back then and saying, isn't it strange that they weren't showing this? No, what's strange is that we are showing it today and we have this yeah. lax attitude towards it today. I think that's
right. I see. That's the point. But, I mean, with regards to the bearing of the breasts and stuff, I mean, that's
the odd one out,
isn't it?
That's the odd thing, is that these goddesses have their breasts out. That's the strange thing. And when you see other images like fertility images, you often see like a pregnant belly and a wide open vulva and sort of quite lewd versions of the goddess. Whereas these, they just had the breasts out. It's strange. It's a bit of a
maybe,
mystery.
The woman being, if it was a matriarchy and the woman was being shown to give birth, that in a state of pain, maybe it's a negative association they didn't want to bear. I mean, with a woman's got her breasts out, that's a symbol of her beauty, I would say. So maybe that's why they compromised there and not necessarily procreating. And also, if you're showing a woman procreating with a man, who would in that instance be a bit more dominant, that would kind of go against her being more powerful than the man. So I don't know, maybe that's the reason why they didn't highlight that as well.
That's a good point. Yeah, and there's another issue as well. The images of the goddess with the bare breast, she's holding a snake in either hand. So it's showing a link between the woman and the snake. And of course, you've got the link in the Bible between Eve and the serpent. And this goddess woman also appears to have a cat sat on her head. It's quite bizarre. Childcare was a central job for women within Minoan society. I mean, it's so bizarre for me. Why do they have to point that out? Of course, it's a central job for mothers to bring up their children, but they have to point this out. Childcare was a central job for women within Minoan society. Evidence for this can not only be found within art forms, but also within the Linear B script found in Mycenaean communities. Some of these sources describe the childcare practices common within Minoan society, which help historians to better understand Minoan society and the role of women within these communities. They were mothers. They had to be mothers to their children. They weren't able to be feminists and go out to work, because that would have meant there was nobody to look after the children, and the nation would have ended up committing suicide. They could see these things back then, the sort of things we fail to see today, I think. Minoan dress representation also clearly marks the difference between men and women. Minoan men were often depicted clad in little clothing, while women's bodies, specifically later on, were more covered up. And this is, why when the Israelites were circumcised, it could be seen that they were circumcised. They were different to other men, because men would work naked a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. It's, I guess, sort of like the sauna culture that they still have today in Scandinavia. And also because it was so hot. So men didn't used to wear many clothes, but the women did. They would cover up. While there is evidence that the structure of women's clothing originated as a mirror to the clothing that men wore, fresco art illustrates how women's clothing evolved to be more and more elaborate throughout the Minoan era. Throughout the evolutions of women's clothing, a strong emphasis was placed on the women's sexual characteristics, particularly the breasts. Female clothing throughout the Minoan era emphasized the breasts by exposing cleavage or even the entire breast. Similar to the modern bodice women continue to wear today, Minoan women were portrayed with wasp-like waists. This means that the waists of women were constricted, made smaller by a tall belt or a tight lace bodice. Furthermore, not only women, but also men are illustrated wearing these accessories. And I wouldn't say that that was indicative that these men were dressing like women. Men wear tall belts to help them with lifting today. And the fact that they were showing these wasp-like waists on the women, I mean, that shows a European beauty ideal. If you look at, a Negro beauty ideal, it would be much larger haunches, because when you look at the Negro women from 200 years ago, particularly the Hottentot women, they had very, very large haunches, and that was seen as attractive. And still today, you get African Americans that likes a big booty, they like a big backside, so that's an African beauty ideal, whereas a European beauty ideal is these very, really wasp-like waists and the hourglass figure, and that's the sort of thing that Europeans like. So I find it interesting that it's the same beauty ideal back then, and we're being told today that this beauty ideal is somehow wrong. And everybody's beautiful and big is beautiful. And do you know what I mean? It's like,
reading that, it kind of made me think of the Victorian era, you know, where they would have the corsets and they would start showing off the cleavage, at least how I remember them being, perceived in films.
Yeah, it shows that we have the same beauty ideal back then as we have today, and maybe breasts in black cultures maybe they weren't seen as so much of a sexually alluring part of the female body, because
they didn't really wear bras, did they? And they still to this day, really, most African nations, they let them all hang.
Yeah, that's so what I'm saying. That's what I mean. They would just have their breasts out all the time. So they weren't, you know, they weren't seen as something special or something to be accentuated. It was more about the backside, with the African beauty ideal. So again, you can see these differences between the races and in the things that we find attractive. Within Minoan society and throughout the Minoan era, numerous documents written in Linear B have been found documenting Minoan families. Interestingly, spouses and children are not all listed together. In one section, fathers were listed with their sons, while mothers were listed with their daughters in a completely different section apart from the men who lived in the same household. This signifies the vast gender divide that was present within all aspects of society. And again, you know, they make out this to be a huge surprise that men and women would live differently, and that fathers would be identifying with their sons. I mean, the daughters would be married off to somebody, and then the whoever they were married to would be responsible for them and would have to look after them, whereas the sons were looked at as they were going to actually earn the family money, because they would be able to go out and work. So the men and women were used for different purposes. Instead of trying to get the women to compete with the men and try to do the same things as the men, that they would get the women to do what women are best at, and the men would do what men are best at. And also, you know, this separating between the two, even within the same household, I mean, that still goes on today, doesn't it? In Muslim countries, they still have big separations between men and women. Where everything is different is how we live today, not how they were living back then. It's the modern world that is completely at odds with nature and everything that's gone on in the past, I think, not the other way around.
Yeah, definitely. And that's obviously down to the way we've constructed our societies, especially the last 50 years or so, since women have obviously gone to work and competing for jobs, it's slowly just started to change the order of society and how things flow, you know. Right.
It's weakened it.
It's all about profit, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weakened it. It's weakened society, and the bonds are breaking down between families, between man and wife, between children and their parents. It's all breaking down basically. And this guy or whoever's people that are writing this are looking back then and saying, "Isn't it strange? Why did they do this instead of living like we do today?"
Hmm. Yeah, it's funny. I get emails from some. I signed up to Quora. You know, the Quora where there's loads of answers and to different questions. Yeah. And I get emailed now and again. And the kind of tripe you get on there nowadays, it started out all right. But nowadays, it's just like a propaganda machine. There was this one comment and it was talking about something to do with some ancient Scots. And then the way that it was framed, the story, it was almost as if it was racist to identify with racially akin people back then and to call them Scottish because firstly, you know, you need to you identify on the grounds of have you lived in Scotland for such a period of time. So there was, you know, there's people in there getting in their own kind of just bias, backwards bias, and these are kind of being featured as the top answers. It's quite sad, really.
It's projection. People project their own mindset and onto people of the past and then don't understand why they behaved in the way they did, or they judge them and say that they were evil people for behaving in the way that they did without understanding the reasons for it. Now, two famous Minoan snake goddess figurines from Knossos show bodices that circle their breasts but do not cover them at all. These striking figures have dominated the popular image of Minoan clothing and have been copied in some reconstructions of largely destroyed frescoes, but few images unambiguously show this costume, and the statues and the status of the figures, goddesses, priestesses, or devotees is not at all clear. What is clear from pieces like the Agia Triada sarcophagus is that Minoan women normally covered their breasts, but priestesses in religious contexts may have been an exception. So it's really just these goddess figurines that are actually showing their breasts, but they are accentuated in the other images that we have. But I guess the image of the goddess with her bare breasts, that's sort of overtaken everything, and people think that that's what they're all like, walking around like that.
Yeah, so I guess, it's a Greek culture, isn't it? But before, in other Greek cultures, you tend to have the male that was the figure of beauty. So in this culture, I mean, obviously the men and the gender roles were the same. It's just their vision of beauty was defined by the woman, the female form, as opposed to the male form. What do you think?
Yeah, and it was actually the Minoans that exported their ideas about civilization to the Greeks, because this civilization took place before the Greek one. I think the Greeks invaded and took them over at some point.
Okay. The Minoans, are they linked to the Etruscans by any chance?
I'm not sure. I didn't turn up anything that said that they were linked to the Etruscans. The Etruscans were in... Where Rome was before.
Yeah,
Rome.
Maybe it's a little later on.
Yeah, we'll get into them as well, because there was a British king that went over, and the Etruscans were paying fealty to the king of Rome, and the British king went over there and defeated the king of Rome, and the Etruscans and the Romans were then paying fealty to this British king, Brennus and Belinus, they're called. There's an episode on it in Greatest Britons, but the Etruscans had a lot of degenerate art as well by the time of the end of their civilization. I forget the name of the guy that wrote The Myth of the 20th Century. He was writing about the Etruscans a lot, and he wasn't quite sure whether they were actually European because the artwork was so degenerate. I'm trying to think of his name. Rosenberg, right. That's it, Rosenberg.
Okay.
In The Myth of the 20th Century.
They tend to depict... I think from what I remember, they tended to depict their men and women in the similar way, with more reddish skin, and the women would be a bit more fair, you know.
But. Well, yeah, because also we forget that a lot of this was in colour. I mean, we're used to seeing these Greek statues as in just in marble or in white or in plaster casts, and they used to be painted, didn't they? Very bright colours. When they actually discovered the paint that was on them, they discovered that they all had blonde hair as well, because they'd been sort of depicting them with dark hair, and they actually had blonde hair.
Another thing to note is a lot of the browner colours would have faded over time anyway and become grew more dark. So I think that's why some people try and claim that they weren't actually, you know, of white stock.
These frescoes in Crete as well, they're very, very bright colours. And also the houses. I saw a picture of how Athens was back in classical Greece, and just a riot of colour. Everything was painted really, really bright colours. Sort of quite different today, where we have our brick-built houses. Everything back then was all bright and sparkling. No litter, of course. And you imagine those great colosseums that they built, and the temples, and, you know, they must have looked absolutely incredible in their heyday. Yeah, and they're still here today.
All natural rock as well. I think sometimes when you're looking around cities, modern cities, it just looks so out of sync. You know, like it just I don't know, just something about a homogenous society where you'd have the materials and the buildings are homogenous. It's just something about that.
And how much of what we build today is still going to be there in 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years' time? None of it. I mean, today we've got dolmens that are still standing from 4,000 years ago. In Britain, where our ancestors put three big stones in the ground and then put a huge capstone on top. This is what I was referring to earlier about, you know, one of them's got a 100-ton capstone on the top of it. I mean, how did they do that back then? And these things are still standing today, 2,000-3,000 years later. Yeah. And we've got these glorious temples and the Colosseum that was built by the Greeks and the stuff that was built by the Romans, 2,000 years old, and it's still standing. And then what have we got today? We've got these horrible monstrosities that we build. I mean, the concrete's going to all be rotten. The things that are made of glass and steel, they're all going to be rusty. Glass is all going to be broken. There's going to be nothing left there. It's we're not building in tune with the natural world anymore. We're just...
True.
Back then, they built things to look beautiful and to look pleasing to the eye, and now we're far more utilitarian and just think about, you know, how many people can we fit into this, and what's the most practical thing we can build. The actual beauty of a thing, it escapes them now, I suppose, because it's too elitist, far too elitist to build something for the sake of beauty. Well, getting into the language, Minoan is an unclassified language, or perhaps multiple indeterminate languages, but written in the same script. It has been compared inconclusively to the Indo-European and the Semitic language families, as well as to the proposed Tyrrhenian languages, or an unclassified pre-Indo-European language family. Several writing systems dating from the Minoan period have been unearthed in Crete, the majority of which are currently undeciphered. So it's interesting there that they say that it's close to Indo-European, and it's also close to Semitic. And we would say that the Indo-Europeans and the original Semitic language families were essentially the same, because the Europeans were Semites. You know, you're talking about white people from back then, not the Semitic types of today. The Semitic languages today go back to Arabic, but what we're talking about here is the language that the Akkadians were using, and the Hittites and the Sumerians.
Is that like the Paleo Hebrew or
Paleo Hebrew? Paleo Hebrew came from Phoenician, and Phoenician came from where did we trace it back to? We traced it back to Akkadian, a mix of Akkadian, which was Semitic, and Sumerian, which was Hamitic, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, language just suddenly, again, that was another thing that just suddenly burst forth around about the time of this flood, about 3000 BC. Before then, they had marks, but they didn't actually have proper language. And then after that, they suddenly had a proper language that everybody was using, and that was Sumerian. and then suddenly you find that you've got different languages that are now classed as Indo-European and Semitic and Hamitic and the various other different types. And they all occur after this original Sumerian language, because if you remember when we did the podcast on the Tower of Babylon and the way that languages got changed, because that ties in with the evidence that we found. There was just this one language that everybody spoke and understood, which was Sumerian. And then at around about 3,400 or 500 BC, we suddenly get these other languages appearing. And the first one was Akkadian, Babylonian. And that had some of the Sumerian words in it still. And then we've got evidence of the Hittites using their language. And the Hittites, that I think they called them Indo-European. And then you've got the Semitic languages as well, which they called Semitic. And then you got Egyptian hieroglyphs as well, which we'll get into next week. But this Cretan one, they haven't been able to translate it, and they just say that it's been compared to Indo-European and Semitic or Shemitic.
I wonder why it's not been able to be deciphered. Is it they just don't have enough material?
Well, you have to find like a cipher, don't you? You have to find one piece of text in one language, and then you have to have the same piece of text again but written in another language that you do understand. It's like when they came to the Behistun rock in Persia, which mm-hmm. talked about these captives that were actually the tribes of Israel. It then calls these captives Hebiru, Scythians, Cimmerians, and I think something and Gomri. And because we knew how to read one of those languages, we were able to, from that, we were then able to translate these other three languages. So we had Assyrian, Babylonian, and I forget what the other two were. And it was the same with the Rosetta Stone, where you had the same piece of text, but it was written in two different languages. And that was how they were finally able to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics. Because on the Rosetta Stone, it had one piece of text written in Egyptian hieroglyphics, and then the same piece of text but written in another language. Because what these kings would do, they would want to say, "I'm a great king and I've done this amazing thing," and they would want everybody to be able to read it. So they would have it. They would have the same thing written out in different languages and then put on a stone. And you need to find something like that to definitively be able to translate. So until they find...
That's interesting. I wonder how they did the Sumerian language then, because, you know, that was obviously truly unique and there was nothing else like it. So I really wonder how they managed to decipher some of that.
Well, the same way. I mean, the Behistun rock, that's got Sumerian on there and Assyrian and Babylonian. So
it was comparable. The people at the time knew how to translate it. It's just that we don't directly, so we have to use frame of reference. I see.
It is theorized that the civilization was destroyed by a volcanic eruption in 1500 BC on the Isle of Thera. One of the largest volcanic explosions in recorded history, it ejected about 60 to 100 cubic kilometers of material and was measured at 7 on the volcanic explosivity index. The eruption devastated the nearby Minoan settlement at Akrotiri on Santorini, which was entombed in a layer of pumice. Although it is believed to have severely affected the Minoan culture of Crete, the extent of its effects has been debated. Early theories proposed that volcanic ash from Thera choked off plant life on the eastern half of Crete, starving the local population. However, more thorough field examinations have determined that no more than 5 millimeters of ash fell anywhere on Crete. Based on archaeological evidence, studies indicate that a massive tsunami generated by the Thera eruption devastated the coast of Crete and destroyed many Minoan settlements. Although the late Minoan period is characterized by affluence with wealthy tombs, burials and art, and ubiquitous Knossian ceramic styles, by several centuries after the eruption, Knossos' wealth and importance as a regional center had declined and the civilization was over. And then it took another 3,000 years before it was discovered again by this British archaeologist.
Wow. And long time.
there are theories that there was an invasion, maybe the Greeks fought against them, but they don't actually have any evidence of it. So they're just saying, well, this volcanic eruption we know did happen, and there was ash there. So I guess they're just theorizing that there was a tsunami. But there was all sorts of cataclysms like this. We will do one episode on all these cataclysms eventually, but that's the Minoan civilization of Crete, and I think we'll finish there, and we'll get into the Egyptian civilization next week. So thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.